we have our next speaker is Dr. Crystal Ng. She is a hydrologist who joined the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Minnesota in 2013. She uses hydrological models and field data and statistical methods to look at how different aspects of affecting the hydrological cycle, including the atmosphere, plants, soil, microbial activity, and geochemistry, interact with each other. Her current Minnesota-focused projects include investigating the role of groundwater in sulfate transport and fate on the Iron Range, predicting the effect of vegetation change on aquifer recharge statewide, and modeling the release of arsenic in affected aquifers. I appreciate you taking the time today to come speak with us, Dr. Ng.
Okay, well, thank you very much. So as you can see from the title of my talk, I'm going to be telling you about what are called secondary water quality impacts from the Bemidji oil spill site. But really, I wanted to put this work within the longer historical context of work at the Bemidji oil spill site because, it's really a tremendous site. It is the Bemidji oil spill site is a USGS long-term monitoring and research site, and it has contributed tremendously to our understanding about the fate and transport of hydrocarbons in the subsurface. And so the work that I've been involved in looking at secondary water quality impacts really just amounts to two papers among over 250 papers that have come out of this site. So I do want to acknowledge Barbara Beacons and Jared Trost. Oh, I'm sorry, Jared. I just realized that I have a typo in your name. Obviously, Jared is spelled with an E, from the USGS. They helped me put together a lot of these slides so that I could give you that greater context. And Jared is here, and so hopefully he'll be able to help me address some of the questions that you guys have more generally about the site. I think this is why I have this, right? Okay, so I know a lot of you might be familiar with the Bemidji oil spill site, but I know not everyone, so I wanted to start out with some background. So in August of 1979, a crude oil pipeline burst near Bemidji, and this released, 1.7 million liters of light crude oil onto glacial awash deposits. And so despite efforts to clean up that oil in 1980, about 400,000 liters still remain. And much of that oil has infiltrated the Vado Zone, and it's formed a pool of oil near the rupture site. And so this is called the North Pool, the North Pool. There was also a lot of spray of oil onto the surface, and some of that has flowed south and before infiltrating and forming what is known as the South Pool. Okay, so not long after the spill site, Olaf van Cook of the U and other scientists really had the tremendous foresight to recognize the potential of this site as a research site. It's relatively removed from populated areas and from major surface waters, and so it really served as an ideal place to look at the natural evolution of hydrocarbons in the subsurface. So here are some pictures that I was able to find off the USGS site. And I must say, actually, joining the department here has felt pretty exciting to be in the same department as Olaf, who has really played an instrumental role in developing what has really become a world-class research site. So anyway, a lot of the concerns driving the work at Bemidji centered around BTEX. So BTEX, for those of you unfamiliar with this, refers to a suite of volatile organic carbons consisting of benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylenes. And there's a lot of concern about them because of their adverse health effects. So they are sensory irritants, and probably most critically, benzene is a known carcinogen. And what makes matters even worse is that benzene is also highly soluble, which means it readily dissolves into groundwater where it can, you know, be transported to threaten drinking wells and surface water bodies. Okay, so at the time of the Bemidji oil spills, light's just flickering. Okay, so at the time of the Bemidji oil spill, there wasn't a lot that was well known about how BTEX degrades. In fact, a lot of what was thought about how it degrades have turned out to be wrong. So here's what was thought. It was believed that BTEX degradation biodegradation requires oxygen, and it was believed that oxygen would be quite plentiful in the aquifer where these plumes exist. So as you'll see, Bemidji really served to kind of dispel a lot of these misconceptions. So here's yet another photo that I was able to get off the USGS website, and it appears that in 1979, another interesting idea is that one smokes while collecting data at monitoring wells. Okay, so a lot of the research at the Bemidji oil spill site focused on, I talked about how there are two different oil plumes, and so much of the research has focused on the North Oil Pool and its plume. So a lot of that research has kind of covered this transect right here, starting from the oil body and extending down gradient towards this unnamed lake. And here's a cross-section to give you an idea of just how much research has been done. So all these are monitoring wells. So they're serving the purpose to track hydraulic head to look at transport and flow of groundwater, and to be able to sample groundwater chemistry. And with all that monitoring, here's what has been found. So remember, sort of the theme of what was believed before was oxygen, right? That really aerobic processes are really prevailing in BTEC's biodegradation. But this is what was observed with all those monitoring locations. So around the oil body in the vadose zone, we really have depleted oxygen. And actually emanating out from the oil pool, we have these anaerobic pools. These anaerobic plumes. Okay, so this is really changing the idea of what we know about BTEC's biodegradation. So kind of put all together, what the data really showed was that naturally, due to naturally occurring microbial activity, BTEC degrades anaerobically, not aerobically. And so a lot of the observations demonstrating this were presented in a series of three papers shown here. And also really noteworthy is that samples from Bemidji really served as a lot of the first demonstration of BTEC degradation coupled to anaerobic iron reduction. So that was a really important finding. So there are further studies that really kind of fleshed out more of our understanding about these anaerobic processes. It was found that in addition to anaerobic iron reduction, anaerobic biodegradation is also coupled to methanogenesis. And it was found that there are a lot of anaerobic metabolites as well, forming plumes. So early model results showed that, contrary to the idea about aerobic processes, these results show that actually probably more than half of the BTEC that's degrading is degrading anaerobically. So all this put together really helped to support the development of natural attenuation as an established effect of BTEC's remediation strategy. So in other words, the natural microbial activity can effectively degrade BTEC's even after oxygen is depleted. Okay, so I think I've hopefully convinced you that Bemidji has played a pivotal role in understanding BTEC's biodegradation. Okay, but now what? Can we learn about things beyond BTEC's biodegradation from this site? So that brings us to an emerging concern about something that's called secondary water quality impacts, and in particular, what are these impacts as a result of anaerobic bioremediation? Okay, so first, what is anaerobic bioremediation? Well, this is a remediation strategy largely inspired by the effectiveness of natural attenuation, and this involves the intentional injection of organic substances into a contaminated aquifer. And so what this does is that it stimulates the growth of microbial activity, which then allows biodegradation of the contaminant of concern, including chlorinated solvents. Okay, but all this happens as a result of redox reactions. So the organic substance is oxidized, but that's coupled to reduction of some component in the aquifer. And these reduction reactions release a number of different solutes, including manganese, reduced iron, sulfide, and methane. And so these secondary plumes of these manganese, iron, sulfide, and methane, These secondary plumes are our secondary water quality impacts that are triggered by the degradation of our primary contaminant of concern. Okay, so don't get me wrong. These secondary water quality impacts are in no way as nefarious as the primary contaminant of concern, but they result from our intentional perturbation of the system. And so responsible practice, you know, calls for us to be able to limit as much as possible the growth of these secondary plumes. Okay, so really the motivating goal here is to understand what are the processes that are driving these secondary water quality impacts. But a complication is that there's generally pretty limited data at bioremediation sites that are carrying out, you know, this kind of practice. So do we have somewhere where there's been a large input of organic substance into an aquifer where we do have a lot of data? Okay, well, we do, the Bemidji oil spill site, right? That wasn't intentional, but there we have a site where there has been a lot of anaerobic bioremediation due to the input of hydrocarbons, organic carbons, where we have been collecting a lot of data. So the goal of the project was to look at what are the long-term, because we have the data, what are the long-term secondary water quality impacts of the Bemidji oil spill? Okay, and so Bemidji really was the perfect place to be addressing this kind of problem because in all the research looking at BTEX biodegradation, it was necessary to also make a lot of measurements on components beyond the BTEX that were related to the BTEX biodegradation. And these related components really are our secondary water quality impacts and other drivers. So for example, there were a lot of measurements on components of the oil well beyond the BTEX. Here's just an example here. These chromatograms, here are two chromatograms from 1983 to 1999. And these spikes indicate the N-alkane fraction in the oils. And so you can see over this time that these spikes really go away. And so this is revealing that there's been a lot of degradation of N-alkanes, and this is suggesting that that comprises a lot of the oil degradation at the site. Okay, so I mentioned methanogenesis has been observed at the site, and so these measurements of methane, well, those are secondary plumes. These are the secondary effects that are being triggered by the breakdown of the oil. So does all the degrading carbon, does it all go into the groundwater to cause these secondary impacts? Well, there have been measurements of surface CO2 gas efflux with devices that look like this at Bemidji that help us address this question. And so in this plot here, you're looking at distance from the center of the oil body, and here's the oil body depicted right here. Well, you can see that there's clearly very elevated carbon dioxide, elevated flux right above the oil body. So this is suggesting that, okay, well, maybe it's not all about plume impacts. Maybe a lot of that degrading carbon is actually going into the atmosphere. Okay, so there was also, you know, in addition to methanogenesis, I already was talking about how Bemidji was really important for establishing anaerobic iron reduction. So measurements of iron in the aquifer can convey to us just how important this process is. So once again, looking at distance from the center of the oil body, you can see that these extractions of iron, ferric iron minerals looks quite depleted near the oil body. So this is because a lot of that iron is being reduced during this redox processes, and it's producing elevated levels of ferrous iron in the aquifer. So that's producing right there, those elevated concentrations. There's your secondary plume of the iron. Okay, but interestingly here, it's not all about the groundwater, because actually extractions are showing that a lot of that reduced iron is actually ending up on the sediments. Okay, so can we bring all this data together? Well, we can, and they show us that there are long-term secondary water quality impacts at the Bemidji site. So here's going on 30 years after the spill occurred. So what you're looking at here are observed concentrations over the North Pole cross-section. So actually this little box here kind of corresponds to this box here in the schematic, and you've got these warmer colors for the higher concentration. So here, okay, we can see the plumes of the BTEX and other organic carbons. These are these metabolites. And so these are becoming degraded in the plume, and these are driving the secondary plumes of the iron and the methane. So as we can see 30 years on, we still have these, we still see these secondary plumes occurring. So we wanted to be able to probe beyond this, though. We wanted to be able to understand what are the controls, what are the controls producing and limiting these secondary plumes. And so specifically, we're focusing on these secondary plumes of iron and methane. Okay, so to address this question, we really had to delve into the data. So these secondary plumes are produced by the degradation of the oil and of the organic carbon. So understanding the processes that link these really calls for fully representing both the source side and the sink side of these biodegradation And so this is where it was really important to have a site like Bemidji, where there's been all this abundant data collected. So here's the data that we compiled for our secondary water quality impact. And so, I'm not going to read all these references out loud, but as you can see, we really had to leverage and rely on a lot of data looking at these two ends of the processes in order to constrain the kinds of processes that are going on. Okay, so this is a lot of data, right? How do we actually bring it all together? Well, in order to synthesize all this extensive data, we used two different approaches, a geochemical mass balance approach, which led to a reactive transport model. So the particular model that we used is called PHT3D, and that actually couples two different models that, that you may be more familiar with. So one of them is the ModFlow MT3 DMS side for representing the transport. And representing the geochemical side of things, we have the FreakC model, which is able to represent sort of the diversity of geochemical processes that are occurring at the Bemidji site. Okay, so I guess I should mention, so really to bring the model together in order to develop the model for looking at secondary water quality impacts at Bemidji, we were able to do this by calibrating the model to that data, to all that data from Bemidji. Okay, so I'm going to be showing you a simulation movie result, an example simulation result, and I think that this movie really helps illustrate how these secondary water quality plumes develop. Okay, so you're going to be looking at simulations of cross sections. So this is once again that North Pole cross section that you're looking at, and we've got the oil pool starting right here. And so these simulations are going to be starting at the time of the spill. And the warm colors are elevated concentrations, and blue is depleted. So up here in the corner, you've got the total dissolved organic carbon. So that's kind of driving things here. And then we've got our secondary plumes of iron, methane, and also, you know, we can consider this as a secondary plume too of an anaerobic plume. So this is dissolved oxygen. Okay, so I'll let it just sort of run here. And what you can see right away is that the plume's growing, right? The plume's growing for all of these. But here's sort of an interesting thing. Here's that dissolved organic carbon. It kind of starts to stabilize, doesn't it? Well, this is exactly because those natural attenuation processes are kicking in. So we have the biodegradation of this organic carbon coupled to the iron reduction in methane. So great, so this is attenuating, but because the attenuation processes release iron and methane and use up oxygen, we actually see these secondary plumes growing. Okay, so sort of this primary plume isn't really growing so much because of the attenuation, but this is where we get the triggering of the secondary effects. Okay, so really bringing together the model helped us clarify a lot of the processes that are happening at the site. So this is a very busy plot, but let me just walk you through it a little bit. So this is what we always knew about. We knew that there's dissolved BTEX and these other forms of organic carbon coming out of the oil pool. And we know that BTEX and that organic carbon is degrading methanogenically and with iron reduction. We know that with that iron reduction, we have some of that iron coming off of the sediments as well, but I'll come back to that. But additionally, what we're actually finding, if we're actually putting together all the fates and all the sinks and all the sources, is that there's actually a really large amount of N-alkanes that are degrading just in place in the oil body, mostly methanogenically, and a lot of that methane is directly outgassing. So that's kind of totally bypassing the plume and being released to the atmosphere. So one thing to kind of keep in mind is I keep talking about methane, but it becomes oxidized as it travels through the vadose zone. And so what you end up measuring at the surface is CO2. And so we're able to track a lot of this based on those, based on the CO2 efflux measured at the surface. All right, so this is a pretty busy plot. So we can also use these simulation results to sort of focus in more on a lot of the processes and to be able to quantify just how important each of these processes are for producing these secondary plumes. Okay, so let's focus first on the methane. So we know that methane's occurring and it's producing this methane plume, right? That's our secondary water quality impact. Okay, so this pie chart represents all the methane that's being generated coupled to the oil degradation. And this little red sliver here, that's the methane that ends up in our plume. That's our secondary impact right there compared to all the methane being released. So this was really, you know, we think this was a pretty staggering result. So it turns out that actually most of the lion's share of the methane being produced actually does not affect groundwater. It actually becomes, or doesn't stay in groundwater. It does affect it geochemically, but it becomes outgassed. And in fact, of what's outgassed, so the outgassed part's that blue part here, but of what's outgassed, most of it is actually directly outgassed and doesn't even from that N-alkane fraction. Okay, so this is a pretty, we thought dramatic result, but we have found that others see sort of a similar prominent kind of makeup of vapor flux over groundwater flux at other sites, including this one in California. Okay, so we can kind of do a similar sort of analysis to look at iron. So that was our other secondary plume here. So again, this pie chart is the result of all the iron reduction that's occurring at the site. And this red, once again, is that little sliver that happens to be the iron that goes into the groundwater. So once again, that's a really small piece. While most of all the other iron that's reduced actually ends up on the sediments. And what our model results show, and so maybe I'll skip over this part for the interest of time, but what our model results actually help suggest is that a lot of that iron is sorbed onto the sediments rather than precipitating out as a mineral form, which we think could possibly have some impacts on the stability of this iron that's sitting on the sediments. Okay, so let's kind of take a step back and look at what we've learned from the Bemidji oil spill site about long-term secondary water quality impacts. Well, first of all, yeah, they occur. So 30 years on after the oil spill site, we're still seeing these growing plumes of iron and methane, even though the organic carbon is being attenuated. So what's controlling these? Well, for the methane plume, it's being driven by degrading oil components, but it's really driven by, you know, the diversity of the different components, each of which have very distinct degradation properties. But the caveat is that probably what we would have expected its impact to be on the groundwater is really very attenuated. Almost all of the methane that gets produced at the site is actually outgassed. So yeah, we do have these secondary impacts, but a lot of it is actually being attenuated. So it's actually a similar story for the iron plume. So the iron plume is being driven by reduction of iron, ferric iron oxides, although this is a little part that I didn't have time to go into. It looks like at least near the oil body, that supply could be depleting. But again, you know, considering how much iron is being reduced, there is actually a fairly maybe limited secondary impact because so much of that iron is then sorbing or precipitating on sediments. So I think really a lot of the takeaway of this is that we do get these secondary water quality impacts, but their overall effect might not be what we expect because of all these more complicated geochemical coupled reactions that involve the vapor phase and the sediment phase as well. So here's sort of the interesting thing. You know, we really started out with oil degradation, BTEX degradation, driving, you know, our study looking at secondary water quality impacts. And what we found is we can actually circle back around and use our secondary water quality impact model to kind of further flesh out what we know about oil degradation. So one way of doing that is actually to now include in the pie chart all the different processes that are coupled to oil degradation and to think about what are the processes that make up most of the oil degradation. And, well, you can see blue is the methane, and, well, that carries the day. So really a lot, most of the oil degradation is occurring coupled to methanogenesis. A small but significant amount is also coupled to iron reduction. So recall that a lot of this happened kind of directly in the oil body. So if you do start focusing in on what can affect the groundwater plumes, though, actually methane and iron become kind of more equal players. All right, so the last few minutes I'll just kind of talk about, here's the epilogue to my study, or to our study. So beyond secondary water quality impacts, well, research at the Bemidji site continues and is thriving. So there are additional studies taking place there. A number of them are focusing, again, on the groundwater plume, looking at yet other secondary water quality impacts that we did not consider. One of those is arsenic. So arsenic is being both mobilized and immobilized in the plume, and there's studies going on trying to understand what affects those processes. So heat, you know, maybe not so much a water quality impact, but it's also being generated from biodegradation being transported. There are also some newer studies that are really looking more in depth at these oil metabolites that I kept pointing to, looking at possible health effects of that. And the list goes on, looking at the plume. So on the oil side, there are a lot of studies going on as well. John Niebuhr's group recently published a paper looking at hydrophobic soils, which have been found to inhibit plant growth, and there's been interest in looking at new remediation strategies for that. And there are also many more studies that are focusing on what's called the source zone. So this is where the oil pool is, really delving more into detail into sort of the complexities, the temporal complexities and the oil composition complexities of that source zone. Okay, so, you know, I think one theme that I want to talk about here is the Bemidji site really has a lot of potential for learning a lot. So, you know, this goes beyond BTEX, beyond biodegradation. It's also a really great site for looking at methods development. So here's a sort of a laundry list of a number of different efforts that are, you know, that are being developed using the site. So a lot of this research is possible, and it's possible to continue because of the collaboration between the USGS and its partners, including the MPCA, Beltrami County, and Enbridge. And so these collaborators and partners are really working together to maintain, promote, and make accessible the research at the site so that we can all benefit to learn more about hydrocarbon contaminants and its degradation. Okay, so I just want to end by saying that, you know, I hope that I've conveyed to you the idea that the Bemidji oil spill site really is a unique and active research site, and I think that this slide really drives home that point. Here's all the different kinds of monitoring that's going on at the site, and as you can see, it's a pretty impressive list. I think another thing that really sets the Bemidji oil spill site apart is its open accessibility. So a lot of other hydrocarbon spill sites are located on you know, refineries or in urban areas where access can be fairly restricted. This is not the case for the Bemidji oil spill site, and actually I really see this as sort of a community resource to learn about hydrocarbon degradation, really going much farther beyond that. And I think it's really exciting that, you know, we have such a world-class research site here in our state. And so actually along those lines, I believe in the next couple of weeks, there's actually the USGS is going to be putting out a call for an RFP, a request for proposals for new studies at the Bemidji site. I think I got that right, maybe timeline of some weeks. And so if you are interested in that or just more generally interested in this site, please do visit the project website here. And I do also want to point out that Jared is the site coordinator, and he's right over there, and and he can probably tell you even more about the site, or especially about general aspects of the site than I can. So definitely, in addition to asking me questions, definitely do seek him out as well. All right, so thank you for your attention.
We have a minute or two for a few quick questions.
I was just going to ask, the oxidation of that of the methane to the carbon dioxide, that's rather startling. I guess I'm going to have to adjust my intuition a little bit. But I was wondering what the process or physical processes you think might be associated with the transfer of the methane from the dissolved to getting up into the Vados zone, the physical processes. Are we talking bubbles or?
Yeah, so there have been some studies looking at kind of vapor processes and bubble processes. So that's sort of speaking to how does the methane actually get from the aquifer even to the water table. So sort of an interesting conclusion of our study is that in order to actually account for so much gas efflux, so it does end up oxidizing to CO2 as it travels through the Vados zone, we actually had to account for the fact that a lot of that methane, just kind of the lion's share of that methane, is actually not even entering into the groundwater plume at all. So sort of our usual conceptual model is that the methane is dissolving. It's you know, generated in the plume, in the groundwater, and it's first sort of appearing as dissolved methane. You reach that solubility limit, and then it begins to outgas. And so there probably are, you know, bubble formation processes that allow it to come to the water table. So that's there. That occurs. And there have been some actually modeling studies that even, well, modeling and, you know, measurement-based studies looking at the bubble formation. But it seems like there's actually a lot of methane that totally kind of bypasses that groundwater phase. And that, you know, actually, so I think that a lot of the model has been suggesting processes. I'm not sure that we have totally resolved exactly physically how that's happening. And I actually regret taking out, I had a couple of references in here that have pointed to other experimental work looking at kind of vapor transport in the Vados zone, where experimentally they are finding that this process is occurring maybe because of sort of, you know, we have preferential pathways for groundwater flow, but sort of a similar idea for, you know, Vados transport through the, or vapor transport through the Vados zone.
Yeah, and I was just going to comment, I wouldn't assume that most of the methane is being produced in the saturated zone. A lot of the mass is in the unsaturated zone, and there's certainly enough moisture for the bacteria to be generating lots of methane. And as far as, okay, you know, production of CO2, you can degrade up to 40 grams per cubic meter per hour if there's any oxygen in the unsaturated zone. So it's not a surprise that that methane's being rapidly converted to CO2. Mm-hmm. I was curious, do you have any significant nitrate or sulfate flux into the contaminated area, or is it pretty minimal?
Not really, so I'll try to address both of those issues. So I guess maybe I should have just talked to you before starting the study. You could have just told me that that's where the methane was being produced. So in some ways, you know, we did also expect methane to be produced in the groundwater because of the issue of solubility of benzene. So we know that we have this DOC, this dissolved organic carbon plume, through the groundwater. And so so that's kind of transporting sort of organic carbon. So I would say when a lot of, you know, the studies were focusing very much on BTEX, in some ways that's why there was a lot of focus, I think, in looking at kind of methanogenic processes in the plume. And maybe we were driven a lot to looking at that because we were motivated by looking at secondary water quality impacts. And so what are these kinds of plumes that are forming in the aquifer? But certainly, yeah, you're right. I guess I had even some plots here or more cartoons showing that it really is a lot of the oil really is still caught up in that Vados zone there. So that's number one. Let's see, sulfate and nitrate was your other question. So
yeah, TEX especially is going to go away quickly with sulfate and nitrate. Benzene, it's a little less clear.
But yeah, so there's not a significant amount compared to just the sort of the electron balance of iron reduction in methanogenesis, sulfate reduction and denitrification just are not as significant players in this. There's just not that much naturally at the site.
Okay, thanks.